QSO Today, episode 482, Ram Muthukrishan, VU2 JXN. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. This week was really great for new listener sponsors and donors. The show notes page updates in real time, and the listener sponsors and donors who want to be recognized for their contributions to the QSO Today project are displayed. I do get sponsorships and donations that are anonymous that do not show up on the show notes page. I want to thank the following listeners who became listener sponsors this week. Mark Farrell, VK6OP. Paul Mayer, K7PM, Grayson Evans, KJ7UM, J. Gordon Betty Jr., W2TTT, Matthew Kaufman, N3AR, Robert Swain, W5APO. The following listeners made donations to QSO this week. Paul Mandel, W4PGM, with $150, and Bill Carnett, AH6FC, with a $50 donation. There were additional anonymous donations this week, and those are greatly appreciated. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio, do people still do that?" this podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. I am still producing the podcast every week in spite of the demands made on me and the rest of the Israelis from the war on all fronts. It is the one bit of normalcy that helps to balance out the rest of it. I am posting on the blog portion of this website about the war and attempting to keep the QSO Today oral history somewhat timeless. Ram Muthukrishnan, VU2JXN, really had to dig into Indian magazines and libraries to find anything about amateur radio, and while he had an early interest, he only met other amateurs once he attended college, where he met hams for the first time. As a software engineer by training and trade, Ram has a keen interest in software-defined radio, SDR, homebrewing radios, and CW. VU2JXN is my QSO today. VU2JXN, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Ram?
Yes, indeed, Eric. 4Z1UG, this is VU2JXN.
Ram, thanks for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? And I know, based on some of the stuff that you've written, that it was kind of an ordeal to get there. But I actually want to start at the very beginning because you have an interest in programming and electronics. So let's start there, can we?
Yeah, sure. I first heard of ham radio when I was studying in the school, back in the high school. There was a newspaper article that came out in the local language. So back home, I come from a state called Kerala, down south from Bangalore, where I live currently. We talk a language called Malayalam. There was a newspaper article. I can't find it anymore, unfortunately, but that article talked about four technology-oriented people in the city. It was just a half a page article on a Sunday supplement to the actual newspaper. And one of them was a radio amateur, and his call sign was VU2RGU, Romeo Golf Uniform. He's not that active anymore. He's still active, but not so much active as he was before. But that was the first time I heard of something called ham radio. I had absolutely no way to reach to any of these people. So I asked around a bunch of people, my school teachers and so on. And I didn't get any information about ham radio at that time. Nobody ever knew that something like this existed. So that newspaper clipping was one of my prized possessions for a long time. And then what happened was, I don't exactly recall who told me, but someone told me about a club called Amateur Ham Radio Guild with a call sign called VU2HRG. Somebody said that, I think it came again in a newspaper article or some sort of disaster. After some disaster, I think somebody wrote about an article on ham radio. And then if you want to learn more about this, please contact. And they had given a small address.
Doesn't India have 1,000 languages?
Yes, yes. So each state has got like its own language. And there are many more languages.
But the common language, because of the British, is English.
Yes.
In your school library, did you have any like electronics magazines? Because you also have an interest in computers, which I think also developed very early. Did you have resources like magazines that might have alluded to amateur radio in any of those?
Unfortunately, not so much. There was a very early magazine called Electronics for You. I think it still exists. But unfortunately, I recently had a look at it in a newsstand, and they do review of phone apps and Chinese gadgets and so on. They don't do much of circuits and other things anymore. But at that point of time, it was really great. It used to have a lot of articles, but unfortunately, my school did not have much resources at all. We had a physics teacher, and she was not very hands-on. She knew a bit of computing, basic, and so on. But I didn't really touch a computer until I went to college. Until then, it was just a curiosity. I had read some articles and so on. Unfortunately, not so much of exposure to magazines.
What's interesting to me is, as I've interviewed mostly American amateur radio operators, and the American school system is actually quite different than, say, the European school system, where kids are divided into either a college track or a vocational track at the ninth grade. How does it work where you grew up in India? Are you set on a college track? Is everybody set on a college track, or at least at the end of 12th grade, everyone has the same certificate, or does it go off in different directions?
So we have a 10 plus 2 type of system. So until 10th, everyone is on the same track, and there is no vocational track or any such thing. It's like mostly rote learning. People are preparing for exams and trying to get as much marks as possible. Not so much of extra work other than doing something for science exhibitions and so on. So I did some electronics work during the school. So I'll come back to this. I had some exposure to radio that I missed. I'll come back to this. But so everyone is on this track. After this, people go into the plus two program. Back then, it used to be called as pre-degree when I was doing it. And you can choose a science track or a commerce track or physics, chemistry, maths or physics, chemistry, biology or economics or such kind of things. And then they just branch off into various tracks like engineering or medicine or law or accounting or such kind of things. And pretty much a vocational track like becoming an electrician or a plumber. Unfortunately, those kind of professions are taken up by people who don't do well in academics. Like if they can't get into a college for some reason, then they go into these kind of industrial training institutes. It is actually called ITI and polytechnics, they call. And they are sort of like a second-class citizens to engineers, unfortunately.
Do plumbers make more money than doctors?
Unfortunately, no. They make very, very less money. They make really, really less money here.
I have to tell you, in Israel, plumbers make more money than doctors.
Wow. I didn't know that. Yeah, that's great.
We have a few lawyers in my town that they were lawyers in America, and when they came here, they found they could make more money being plumbers.
Yeah, at least people are not treated equal. That is one part of the society here. People are looked down upon if they do, say, plumbing or because of the income differences, right? Because there is a huge disparity in income of certain professions.
Of people that work with their hands versus working with their heads.
Exactly, yes. There is a huge disparity. And yeah, there is one thing that I wanted to go back to. Back then in the school, we have these science exhibitions every year. My father used to work for a fertilizer company. It's a government funded company. It's like a public sector company, we call here. It is a fertilizer company. So we used to live in what is known as quarters for employees. They give like a bunch of row houses and you could stay there very cheaply. My father's workplace was like just a few steps away from our home. So I used to hang out there very often after school and so on. So one day when I walked into his, so this was a workshop. So this is like a training school for factory workers. And so they had all kinds of mechanical equipments like lathe and all kind of lot of fun stuff. Even though I was not wearing safety gears, I was sort of allowed because I was a son of an employee. So they all knew me and I used to be allowed there inside. And I was really fascinated by all those equipments. And one day when I walked in, I saw my father's manager. He was listening to, he had a proper office. It was not like a factory setting. He had a proper office room. And he was listening to BBC on a radio. And I just saw that it was like completely open with a circuit and with a wire just standing, hanging from that. And he was listening and he was tuning around. And so I asked him, oh, so you made this with your hand and why is it looking like this? So he said, yeah, I just built it. Do you want to build this? So I said, yeah, of course, I want to build it. So he said, okay, let's do this. Let's go to the market on Saturday and get all the stuff required to build this. So we did exactly that. I was so excited. And so he got one of his junior engineers to come with me. And so he took me. So I and him, I was in school at the time, like in eighth or ninth grade, I think. And he took me to the market and this was like a kit with a L board sort of a design. I think it is probably, we used to call it as an L board because it used to resemble like an L letter. And it is like a short wave plus medium wave radio with IF transformers and so on. We bought them. We bought a soldering iron and bunch of wire cutters and other things. And I built it along with him. And we tuned all those IF, 455 kilohertz IF, and tuned it properly. And it worked. And I can't express to you how much happy I was listening to something that I built with my own hand. And we bought a cabinet and everything.
Was this a kit or was this just the raw parts?
It was a kit and it was made by a company called Jet King, JETKING, Jet King. And this would be called an L board radio kit.
If you'll send me the link, I'll put it in the show notes page.
Yeah, sure, I'll do that.
Did your family have a radio and or television at home?
Yes, so we had a radio. At that time, even to have a radio receiver, we needed to have a license from the government, even to have a receiver.
Commercial band radio.
Yes, broadcast radios, yes. So we had a radio for quite some time. It was a Philips radio with an external antenna. And for a long time, I did not know why that antenna is required. My father had tied up on the wall from one end of the wall to the other. Yeah, it was tuning around that radio was really one of my pastimes. And we didn't have a TV for quite some time. I think we bought the TV, a black and white TV, during the Los Angeles Olympics. I think it was 1984, if I remember. There was this company called Uptron that was selling TVs, and TV was really niche at that time. Very few of the houses had TVs. We bought a really cheap TV at that time. It was a black and white TV. It had a wooden cabinet. You could close them.
Yes, I remember. But I remember those from the late 50s, early 60s. In America, they would have those. That meant that there were not a lot of television broadcasting stations then in India, right? There was only just a few?
Just a few. And it was only the state Doordarshan was the Darshan. That was the state channel. Doordarshan literally means in Sanskrit TV. Like Doord means distance. Darshan means vision. there was a local repeating session that came up. Until then, we did not really used to get TV broadcasts at our place. So that's when we bought this TV, and it had a Yagi antenna, and we used to, like, I used to go up and like turn it, and do you see it now properly? And then he used to shout from there, yeah, now don't touch that. And it used to have those twin type cable.
Right, 300 ohm twin lead.
Yeah, 300 ohms cable.
You were the Armstrong antenna rotator.
Yes, yeah. So I built this radio, and that was really introduction to electronics for me. And for the science exhibition, I built some sort of a doorbell. We used to get an IC where you could program, if you program some pins with certain voltages and so on, it will just play some audio, different types of audio. That was one of my early science projects, and people were fascinated that, oh, there is some sound coming out of this. And at that point of time, it was very fascinating. This is like late 80s when I was in school. I did my 10th grade in the year of 1992. I passed out of 10th. So I think these events must have been like around 88, 89, 90, around that time.
Now, it sounds to me like, based on what you've said so far and what I know about you from looking at your blogs and your blog posts, that you took the professional track in the 10 plus 2. And so, where did you end up going to school after high school?
After high school, I went to a college for the pre-degree program. That is like a 2 years degree program. So I studied physics, chemistry, and maths. So there is a local college called Sacred Heart College, which was very near my home. And I used to learn music at that time. So I didn't want to really stop my music class from interfering with other things. So I decided to join a local university for engineering. So there is an entrance exam here for engineering. So the big exam is the Indian Institute of Technology. They are a premier institute here. There is a engineering entrance program. Unfortunately, I did not qualify there because we just had like a handful of seats, and India is like a very populous country, and a lot of people competing for these limited number of seats. So I did not get an admission in one of these premier colleges. So I ended up going to a local university called Cochin University of Science and Technology, CUSAT. That is the name of the university, and I studied electronics engineering there. And interestingly, we had a radio amateur who was a professor there, and his call sign is VU2ITI, India Tango India, VU2 India Tango India. And his name is Mani, Professor Mani. And he was a huge inspiration in the college. So because of the fact that I had only heard of ham radio at that time, this was like the first time I was actually seeing some radio ham when I went to college. So we quickly hit off with each other, and I was one of the few people in the college with some interest in ham radio. So he lent me his old copy of ARRL handbook to me from time to time. So I was mostly immersed with his 1984 copy of ARRL handbook. And we did a bunch of projects together. And one of them was phone patching unit. That is, you keep a VHF set at your home, and you carry around your VHF handy, and you can basically talk to anybody on phone. It was illegal at the time, but we built it.
It was an auto patch.
Yes. What it does is it takes these DTMF keypad inputs, it decodes them, because you put the radio, when you try to transmit, the radio just passes through the audio out. And then you just use some sort of a transformer to couple the audio out, and then pass it to one of those ICs that does DTMF decoding, and use those DTMF decoding to dial the number that you want to...
To access the dial tone.
Yes.
I remember that period of time, and there were things called simplex auto patches. So it wasn't on a repeater. It was actually the base station would drop the transmitter periodically to sample your audio to see if you were talking, if you were transmitting, in order to be able to keep the conversation going. They were quite interesting. That's what you built then. You built a simplex auto patch.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. It was a lot of fun. It was really a lot of fun. Getting those ICs and so on was also, again, pretty hard. But Professor Mani had some ham contacts across the cities and other places, like bigger cities, for example. And he got those components and ICs for us. And a couple of other people also were building these things with me. They turned out to not be so much interested in amateur radio, but... Yeah, at least I was probably one of the only ones in my class who hooked on to it.
And stayed into it.
Yeah. Even to this day, some of my classmates, they tell me that, oh, are you still into Morse code and ham radio? And is it still relevant and so on? Yeah, why I say that, oh, yeah, it's still relevant. It's really alive and kicking and doing much, much better than before.
And now this mid-show break. The future of podcasting and the QSO Today podcast is listener sponsorship. It keeps us lean and focused on providing you the best ham radio interviews since 2014. You can keep the QSO Today podcast commercial and sponsor-free by becoming a listener sponsor yourself. For $10 a month or save 20% at $100 per year, you can become a listener sponsor. I am now recording the QSO Today podcast as video interviews that are available only as a benefit to listener sponsors through our QSO Today community website. As I develop the sponsorship tier, I will add bonus content for listener sponsors. Listener sponsors, not donors, are automatically members of the new QSO Today Academy. I am building the Academy website to include access to our SQL I/O networking lounges all of the time, and Academy resources including over 400 previous expo presentations with Q&A, and additional helpful ham radio educational resources. The benefit of listener sponsorship as an alternative to commercial sponsorship is that commercial sponsors influence the content and comments in the podcast. Listener sponsorship allows a greater degree of freedom to discuss any ham radio subject without commercial consequence. I have eliminated all commercials in the QSO Today podcast from episode 445, with the exception of the Ham Radio Workbench podcast, as I think that this is a serious asset to a well-rounded ham radio education. I am not using Buy Me a Coffee or Patreon, but my own system for managing the community that could form out of the podcast. I direct you to the sponsorship section of the show notes pages beginning with the episode 444, where I list all of the contributors to the podcast since 2014, including sponsors, donors, and hams who have paid for transcriptions. If sponsorship is not your interest, then you can make any size donation to the podcast by clicking on the donation button on the QSO Today podcast website at qsotoday.com. There is a slider that you can use to adjust the amount of your donation. If you want to make your donation monthly, click on the recurring donation box. It is the recurring donations and the listener sponsorships that keep the lights burning here. Finally, you don't have to contribute anything to listen to the QSO Today podcast. You can use my Amazon affiliate link before shopping at Amazon by clicking on it on the right side of the show notes page. This will signal Amazon to send us a small percentage of what you purchase. This is the most painless way to ensure that the QSO Today project will be here next week. I want to thank everyone who has contributed and will contribute to my effort to create this oral history of amateur radio since 2014. It will eventually all be in the public domain for hams in the future to enjoy. Be sure to become a listener sponsor or make a donation today. And now we return to our QSO Today. You did a blog post where you kind of created a timeline on what it took for you to get your license. Do you want to kind of briefly go through that story in terms of, it was actually sometime later that you actually went and actually got the license?
Yeah, so I passed out of college in 1998, and then I went to one of these Indian Institute of Technologies for my master's program. When I went there, to my astonishment, I found that they have a club station, and it was in ruins completely. There was a room in one of the hostel rooms, and it was like it had some really expensive Yasu rigs and so on, and a huge cache of QSL cards. So apparently it was very active during some period of time, and it was like completely in dust, and parts of the cable had been eaten by rodents and so on. So I found another radio amateur student and one of the professors there in the electrical engineering department. I, along with the other student, so we teamed up and we talked to the professor, and we decided to clean it up and try to revive the club. And so we got a dipole antenna up in on top of the terrace of the hostel room, and we got it going to some extent. The rig had some issues, but somehow we got it going. Then I came out of college and I came to this city where I currently live, Bangalore. And this is like a tech capital sort of thing, and there are a couple of clubs here. One of them is called the Indian Institute of Hams, and they have a club call sign called VU2 India Hotel. And there is a small indoor stadium here, and their club office is attached to that indoor stadium. They're mostly active on VHF and so on, but what they do is they train people for the license exam. And a bunch of like scouts and other kinds of students and other people from other parts of the city, they come here and write the exam. So these exams are conducted again by the government during fixed amounts of time, like twice a year or thrice a year. You can't just go to their office and sit for the exam. Like from what I hear from your stories, other stories and QSO today, it looks like in places like the US, you could go to the FCC office and take the exam, and now there are volunteer examiners.
I think in America, these FCC field offices no longer exist for the most part.
Ah, okay.
So I don't think you can go there, but the volunteer system works really well and it's on demand. It's my understanding also that you could probably get an American amateur radio license in India over the internet, right, with the volunteer examiners.
Yes.
Now, you may not be able to operate an American call sign in India as an Indian citizen. For example, I can't use my American call sign in Israel as I'm also an Israeli licensee, and vice versa. I think that's also true. So it seems to me that you sat for the exam, but then I noticed that it actually took quite a long while, with a lot of stuff going back and forth.
It was a long while. A lot of stuff going back and forth. The place where I live and work, and the place where this exam center and the VU2 IIH office was like a bit far away. And what I decided was I would just prepare for the exam myself. And the license system at that time was there were four classes of license. There is a restricted grade and a grade two, grade one, and advanced. Since then, it has been simplified. IIH club authorities, they sort of told me that you better do the restricted grade because the chances of getting the license is really, really high if you do that. So even though I was pretty good at Morse code at the time, I used to use the K7QO code practice files. I still have those in a CD. Recently I found some of the notes that I had made from that CD. It was really nostalgic. So I learned from that code practice files. And for the exam, there are two parts. There is rules and regulations portion, and there is a electronics portion. And since I have an electronics degree, I was exempted from appearing for the electronics part of it. So I could just write the rules and regulations part and do the Morse code test, and I would just pass. And the Morse code test was like 5 words per minute. It was excruciatingly painful, 5 words per minute, where you would make mistakes. If it is faster, yeah, you could at least identify words and at least make a bit more connection in your head. But 5 words per minute is like really, really slow. But yeah, I passed the exam. And after passing the exam, at that point of time, there was a police verification step. So the reason for that, I think one of the reasons is that one of our previous prime ministers was assassinated by this organization called LTTE in Sri Lanka. They were a terrorist organization, and he was assassinated while in an election tour here in India. His name is Rajiv Gandhi. He was also a ham, incidentally, V2RG. And what happened was the people who assassinated him, they were using ham radio frequencies to communicate back to Sri Lanka. And some of the hams had actually listened to that and helped the authorities as well. But unfortunately, with everything with government, right, the people who really helped the government became the victims. And they decided that, oh, now onwards, we are going to background check all the people who apply for this exam. So they decided to employ this intelligence bureau that is under the government of India to do the background verification. And they do this covertly. They don't come to your home or anything. And apparently it was done. So they are supposed to do that within 6 months. And then it goes to Delhi, the capital of India, and it sits there in some huge Department of Telecom office. And the license would come anytime within 1 year. That is the usual norm. In my case, it just didn't come at all. So people say that, oh, forget it for 1 year. Don't even think about it. After 1 year, let's see what would happen. So 1 year passed by after I passed the exam and I sent all the required fees and all the documentation. Nothing happened. And then I started communicating with other hams. There used to be some mailing lists. And so I started communicating with them. There is a national organization called Amateur Radio Society of India, the ARSI, and they were very, very helpful. And I started talking to them. So they had some licensing officer in Delhi. And my Elmer, VU2 ITI, Professor Mani, he also had one of his relatives, one of his uncles or someone living in Delhi as a press person. He was working for one of the newspapers there. And incidentally, he's also a radio amateur. His name is, his call sign is VU2 OB, Sri Kumar VU2 OB. And he helped me to, so he went to the Department of Telecom office, the amateur radio wing. It is called WPC, Wireless Planning Commission. And they opened their offices to public on one particular day of the week.
Nothing like bureaucracies, right?
Yeah, it's like too much bureaucracy. And he helped me to go there, and he figured out that they had finished the intelligence bureau background check long, long back, and they had sent me a letter asking me to send some copy of something that I had forgotten to attach or something, and that letter never arrived. So this time I sent that all the required stuff along with some bank demand draft and everything to Mr. Sri Kumar, VU2 OB, and he personally went to the office and delivered it to them. And the license was issued like within a week.
What's an amazing story about that is to do a background check costs a lot of money. Were your fees to the Indian government for your amateur radio license high?
It's really, really low. It's like 10 rupees. 10 rupees is like, so 80 rupees is $1. So you can imagine. So 10, and at that point of time, maybe 40 rupees was $1. But still, it's like 10 rupees is like you get a cup of coffee from a corner shop for 10 rupees at that time.
They spent thousands of rupees to check you out.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous. They have to choose their enemy, right? We are friendly folks trying to help out people, and we are such a nice community who have helped government during various times. But now they're trying to victimize and add bureaucratic layers to it. But now, happily, they have done away with the intelligence bureau checks and so on. For my daughter, for example, it took like 40 days maximum after she wrote the exam.
You have a 15-year-old daughter. How old was she when she got her license?
She got it when she was in between 12 and 13. So 12 years is the minimum age limit. There is an age limit, minimum age limit for the license. And unfortunately, they have not done away with that. So she was 12. Whenever she passed 12, she was showing some interest with Morse code and so on, right, when she was 10 or 11. And she used to help me with soldering and so on. So we decided, yeah, we are definitely going to do this. And so she wrote the exam. So we sent, again, there was a bit of bureaucracy there. Just before the pandemic, we started preparing for the exam. And we sent the application just before she was 12, I think. And for some reason, we did not hear anything from the website for quite some time. Apparently, they had suspended all the local examinations because it is in-person examination. So they had suspended everything because of COVID-19. We took the first opportunity and got it done again through the Indian Institute of HAMS, VU2IIH. So they, through them, we applied. So we applied directly, and they hold the exam at this indoor stadium facility where like hundreds of people sit and write the exam.
Is your daughter on the air?
Right now, not so much, but yeah, she was on the air for a bit.
What's her favorite operating mode?
She was on SSB, but she wants to do some CW. I have this RSS feed. There is a podcast for, I think it is called Quote of the Day or something. By an American ham, I think it is called. Yeah, there is a Quote of the Day channel, RSS feed, and that, yeah, they send Morse code quote every day. So that is one of my favorite thing that I listen to when I'm on car. I keep listening to it at least daily, just to train myself. So both of us, we try to listen when we are traveling together, try to decode.
You and I were talking before we started, we were talking a little bit about some of the devices that we use, and you yourself use a Google phone, but you have, what was the operating system that you have running on your phone?
Graphene OS.
So you're running Graphene OS on your phone, and that allows you to have a lot of open source applications and things like that on your phone as well. You mentioned RSS feed. A lot of hams may not know, or maybe at one time they used to know, that the way that you would notify someone that you had done a blog post, when that blog post happens, an RSS broadcast is sent out from the blog post. Just so that people know, the QSO Today website also uses RSS, and that's what actually signals the emails that come to you. But it used to be that, and I think that they're still in like Outlook and other email readers, that there are places where you could actually put the RSS address in, and then you don't have to go to the website. It will actually send you that information directly to your email reader.
Yes, I use one of those as well. There's this thing called RSS to email. It's a small Python program. So I use that to follow the RSS feeds like blogs and so on.
Right, so you get an email instead of having to go to the blog post. So I'm going to put a note into the show notes page what an RSS feed is, but I'll also remind people that on the right side of the QSO Today show notes page, both on show notes and also on the blog side, there's a link to the RSS feed, and you can actually take that directly, and you don't actually have to come to the website, although we'd like you to come to the website, in order to read the blog or to get to the podcast audio. So your daughter has an amateur radio license. She likes SSB. She'd like to learn CW. What's your favorite operating mode?
My favorite operating mode is CW. I really love CW. I also did the CW Ops, the CW Academy program just before the pandemic. I think 2019, I started. I was probably one of the first students from this part of the world. It was mostly American-centric, and my classes were like early mornings, 5:30 in the morning was my class time.
I also took CW Academy. It's an amazing program.
Amazing. It's really, really amazing. And hats off to all those volunteer teachers and so on for so much of dedication.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned when I was reading your QRZ page is that one of your first radios was the BitX.
Yes.
Right, but the BitX I thought was a single sideband radio, not a CW radio. Did you modify it so that you could actually operate CW on it?
Yes. When I started off after getting my first call sign, which is VU3RDD, I had a ICOM IC706. I bought it secondhand. I used to use CW there. But for a long time, I was not active with family and so on. And then in 2018, I decided to get back on the air. And unfortunately, I didn't have that rig. I had given it away to another ham in the meantime. And I didn't get it back. So I decided I'll just, the cheapest way to get on the air probably is to buy from Farhan's HF Signals company, which is like one city away. I got one of those kits. It did not have CW, and also it did not have a way to practice CW. So I modified the Arduino code to add a practice mode into that so that it won't transmit it. I could just listen the side tone alone and just I just added a menu entry into it so that when you go into the learn CW mode, I could just practice. As for the filters and so on, I did not do so much of modification. It was very hard to operate CW with it because the bandwidth was pretty high. Also getting into the air was also a bit difficult, but because when you transmit, it never used to transmit on the same frequency. It used to shift out and send out, and yeah, it was hard, but I made some modifications to the code to transmit on the right frequency because it uses a SI5351 to program the VFO and so on. So I made some changes to accommodate that. And there is a CW net every day at 7:15 here, run by another of your guests, Ganesh VU2 Tango Sierra. He was one of your guests as well. And he still runs it to this day. And that was my primary daily CW activity during that time when I got this BitX rig.
You've kind of gone on. You're now using more SDR type radios.
Yes, yes.
These are also Indian-based, aren't they?
I'll tell you a little bit about my SDR history. So there is this project called OpenHP SDR. I think you must be aware of it. Phil Harman and a bunch of other guys started this project way back in 2006, I think. So this is some of the early days when I had just got the license. I used to work for Texas Instruments at that time, working on digital signal processors and so on, like modems and so on, writing software for modems, speech coding and such kind of things. So I had some interest in signal processing. It was one of my favorite classes in the college, and also my master's was also communications and these kind of things. So I decided to participate in those projects, but getting the components and the boards and other things from the US was very, very hard. And so 2008, I think, 2009, my wife had traveled for work to the US. So at that time, I made a huge DigiKey order and got all the components for one of the initial boards delivered to her address, and also got one of the boards made. I think I bought it from Tapper. I think Tapper was just, or Tap, I don't think Tapper was involved at that time. It was just initially a bunch of people making those boards. I decided to put my name on one of those boards, and it was sent to my wife's hotel address in Florida or somewhere, and then I got a bunch of components after like a couple of months when she returned. And then I built that, and that was only the first board. So the OpenHBSDR, the original idea was that you will have a base platform and then you will have a bunch of plugin cards. And I still use that to this day. Let me show it to you. Can you see the one on the top?
Oh, yes. For the people listening on audio and not looking at the video, there's a card cage.
Yes.
With a bunch of cards and connectors sitting on the front.
And this is the amplifier, 100-watt amplifier.
The good old days.
Yeah. And the whole thing still works. It still works really great.
And you use it as a CW rig?
Yeah, I mostly use the CW rig, even though CW is probably such a simple thing to do with that rig. It is capable of much, much more. And there is this software called PowerSDR, which is unfortunately Windows only. But now you have a bunch of other options like LinHBSDR and PyHBSDR. Again, we'll talk about that in a bit.
You're not a Windows user. You're a Debian Linux user. So PowerSDR then is a Windows program that you see on the Flex radios, for example. But you need to come up with some alternatives for Debian.
Yes, some alternatives. So initially, some of my initial days were completely spent on trying to write some code to get the IQ samples out of it and get some samples into the GNU/Linux system and try to do some processing here on the PC. So I used to use the GNU radio project during its early days to do some stuff with it. So I wrote some code to do Hilbert transform and so on, to do SSB decode using the Hilbert transform. I have some code contributed back to GNU radio project to do the Hilbert transform block. So with GNU radio, it is like you have these blocks and you could just join those blocks and to get a complete radio, for example. Like you create a graph of blocks. Now you have UI tools available, but at that time you had to write some Python code or C++ code to join these blocks together. And you could have like one block to do some filtering, for example, and one block to do some undersampling, like to decimate samples or interpolate the samples. And it's a really fun project, the GNU radio project.
I want to take a minute to tell you about my favorite podcast, the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast, with George, KJ6VU, and now joined by Rod, VA3ON, Mike, VA3MW, Mark, N6MTS, and Vince, VE6LK. Every 2 weeks, George and company offer up a status report on the many amateur radio projects on their workbenches and explore projects on their guests' workbenches. This group is project active and prolific, covering many technical areas of amateur radio. So the next time you want a deep dive into ham radio electronic project building, or to learn about technology, tools, test equipment, construction techniques, and the rest, listen to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast, available on every podcast player and channel. Use the link in this week's show notes page to get to the Ham Radio Workbench Podcast directly. And now back to my QSO. What was the Radio Berry? I noticed you talk about Radio Berry. Is this the project you're talking about?
No, this is a different project. So this is a project by Dutch radio amateur by name Johan, PA3 Golf Sierra Bravo, PA3 GSB. So this is a stripped-down version of the Hermes Light radio. So there is this Hermes Light project, which is like a $300 radio, which is like a 5-watt radio. And this is a stripped down version of it. So what this does is it sits on top of a Raspberry Pi 4, like a hat, and you have like a 20 milliwatt output coming out of it. And it uses a small, so what is there on the board is there is an FPGA on it, and there is a cable modem chip on it, which has a high-speed ADC and a DSC. And this cable modem chip is from Analog Devices. It's the same chip used in Hermes Lite as well. AD9866, that is the name of the chip. It's like how much it would have costed me for the board. I homebrewed that board, and that is like maybe around $60-$70 at the time. This is before the chip shortage. This is just before the pandemic that I built this. Now I think with the chip shortage, it must be a little bit harder and must be a bit more costlier to build it. And now there are Chinese AliExpress vendors selling it for maybe double the price of that.
Right. And are you sure that you're getting real equipment?
Yeah, we're definitely not sure about that because some of these chips may be rejected by the manufacturer and being sold. This AD9866, for example.
They should be the shop sweepings and they should have gone in the trash, but instead they're being sold for twice the money.
Yes, exactly. And some people have actually been bitten by that the same chip. They develop problems later on, and there may be physical cracks on the underlying die of the chip and so on. And shop sweeped parts. So this Radio Bury is like very low power output. So another ham, his name is Gopan, VU2 X-ray Tango Oscar. So he built a controller board for it. So you could have some real knobs and switches and so on. So that is my another project now. So it runs a software called PyHPSDR. And this was written by this radio amateur in England by name John Melton, G0ORX, Golf Zero Oscar Radio X-ray. And he has this really nice software called PyHPSDR. And again, all these are variants of the HPSDR project, the original HPSDR, open HPSDR that I was talking to you about, the protocol between the radio and the computer, which is with packet format and so on. It is largely the same even today. Both Hermes Lite as well as the Radio Bury and the OpenHPSDR, they all use the same format to switch filters using I2C protocol and things like that. So Radio Bury itself does not come with any filters or power amplifier or anything. So what I've done is I've built a filter and a 100-watt amplifier based on Jim. Jim, I think you talked to him as well. Jim Veach, he won the NXP prize for, I forget his call sign, but he has this Hard Rock 50 series of amplifiers, Jim Veach. So he has a small 5 centimeter by 5 centimeter, 100 watt board. He uses the same circuit that he won the prize for, the NXP prize, using the MRF 101. It works really, really well. You get 100 watt out for the entire HF. I use that along with, so it needs a 1 watt drive minimum for to get 100 watt out. So I have another small circuit designed by VU2XTO. So I use that to drive up the Radio Bury's output power to 1 watt. And then that 1 watt is fed into the MRF 101 base amplifier. And then there is a filter. So I wrote some code. There is a Raspberry Pico on this. So I wrote the code for it. So VU2XTO, Gopan, he designed the hardware. I wrote the code for it. So we collaborated. We still collaborate on it and make changes and so on. So I modified the PyHPSDR to work with it with a 7-inch screen so that it shows somewhat like IC7300 sort of thing, like a big display, and you could work split and so on. And a couple of people worked using the same software. We have like around 10 users for this hardware-software combination now here locally, who have built the same radio, and they use the software that I've modified. I put the whole thing on GitHub, both the Raspberry Pico software as well as the Raspberry Pi, the modifications that I've done for PyHPSDR. And people have picked it up, and I've added some noise reduction modes on it and so on. People used it last week on the CQWW contest. as well, and that's so gratifying to hear that there are some real users on it, and they come up with feedback saying that, oh, this did not work well. And I myself tried to get into the CW contest last week with this rig, and I found some issues with N1MM talking to this. Again, after one of the person reported some issues, I fixed those issues after that with the WinKeyer and so on. So yeah, it is so gratifying that there are some real users for that, even if it is like handful of users, you get some feedback and you can improve the code, and at least everybody benefits out of these improvements, right? That's the great thing about free software and open source.
Absolutely. What I find so interesting about you, Ram, is that you've made this really large investment in SDR technology, and you just showed me the chassis that you've built. HP SDR is a big project, and you've made a huge commitment to it. But what I find so fascinating about you is that you're now, right now, building a NorCal 40 transceiver, an original design by Wayne Burdick, N6KR, and I remember seeing that radio in the late 90s, I think. So it was pre-Elecraft, Super Heterodyne receiver. All of a sudden, you've gone from there. Now you're kind of like going backwards, and maybe it's not backwards, but you're doing it along with David Rutledge's book, The Electronics of Radio. Can you talk a little bit why you've decided to kind of stop and reverse in order to build this NorCal 40 radio?
Yeah, that's really a great question, Eric. I myself thought about it for quite some time. I bought David Rutledge's book quite a long back before I had any access to NorCal 40. And there was also this book or some sort of booklet on the QRPL mailing list. I think it is mostly spam and other fighting nowadays. I'm not on that. Some of these mailing lists have really sort of dropped down in the signal to noise category, and QRPL is unfortunately one of those lists. I think back in the day, I think they used to have this Elmer's series or something, and they used to work with Dave Benson's kit, one of those Dave Benson's kit, and they produced a series of articles for people to build stage by stage. They explain what would be the voltage, what exactly is this block doing. So I got one of those booklets. It was like long back when I was waiting for the license to come from the government. And then I bought this book when it came out. It was very expensive at that time, like $100, I think.
It's still expensive. It's like $150 on Amazon in hardcover.
Yeah, that's very expensive.
Well, it's a textbook.
Yeah, it's a textbook, college textbook, and college textbooks are for some reason very expensive. I got this book, but again, I did not have any hardware. I did not have access to a PCB or the parts available. I just sat there. I used to read the book, but I was like wondering what to do. I don't have this. And I was not really sure if I buy some transistors locally. I don't have any test equipment at that time. And will it really work? And if it doesn't work, how will I debug? And all sort of questions at that time. So it just sat there for quite some time. And then there is this ham radio convention. It is actually happening next weekend in Hyderabad, run by one of the clubs that Ashraf Farhan is also part of, the La Makan Amateur Radio Club, LARC, I think it is called, La Makan Amateur Radio Convention. They are, so in 2018 or 19, 18, I think, I attended that convention. There was this guy by name Rahul. He is sadly a SK now, Silent Key. Last year, he passed away. He made a bunch of boards for the 25th anniversary edition of NorCal 40 transceiver. So that was a club project for the QRP Tech mailing list. So I got one of those boards, a couple of boards from him when I attended. His call sign is BU3WJM. And yeah, he passed away last year. So I got a couple of those boards. So when he gave me those boards, he told me, please promise me that you will put it to use. And not just put it in your cupboard or somewhere. Most of the people have given this board, they just take this board and they just put it somewhere and they don't build it. But just promise me that you'll actually build this. So I told him, yes, I'll definitely build a radio and I'll email you after I build. That's what I told him. But sadly, I could not email him before that. He passed away. But I decided that I'm definitely going to build it. So I started gathering parts. The folks on QRP Tech also had been building it. And so I built, I'm just doing it section by section. I've hit a roadblock now. I need a bunch of crystals and I need to test the crystals and move on to the next stage. And the motivation level sometimes go up and down with any of these projects, right? Like when you're waiting for some parts, you just feel like, oh, the parts are going to come maybe 1 month later. And then you get hooked to something else during that time. And when the parts arrive, other things have, like you've lost touch on what you were doing 1 month back. So now I started maintaining some notes. I have a notebook where I keep jotting down and what I did, just trying to make sure that it helps me recollect what I was doing before. And but still keeping the motivation is very hard. And one of the reasons why I'm building it is because of the availability of the book. If I read the book and build it along with my daughter, for instance, she can really learn how the radio works. It's not just a black box anymore. And I think the Elecraft K1, I think one of those CW-only rigs was modeled after this kit. That is what I read somewhere. Unfortunately, it is very hard to get Elecraft kits here. I was trying to get a K2 for quite some time.
I think that's the KX1 or the K1.
Yeah, it is KX1. K1, yeah.
Was based on.
Yeah. And getting those commercial radios and especially Elecraft radios here is really, really hard. I've been trying to get one of those K2s for some time. And I really love that K2 radio, the 10 watt. And you can add more and more stuff to it and make it a 100 watt rig. The main motivation was to really understand the radio and at least convey that to my daughter and also write about it so that people, other builders can also go through this. It's like an information out there on the web that others can also use when they get stuck. Because whenever I am stuck, I tend to browse on the web and see if someone else has also gotten into the same problem. Unlike software issues and Stack Overflow and such websites, right? So the failure modes of various parts and circuits are not so much well documented. Like, for example, if an FET blows up, how does it manifest and what are the symptoms that a newbie builder can detect? Like, if I measure voltage or what should I give as an input and what should I observe if an FET is blown up? Or maybe the drain voltage won't even reach the source, even if the gate voltage is varied. Or maybe it's a short, so it will always be like shorted between gate and source. So how does the failure manifest? Those kind of things are not so much well documented, I feel. The data sheets definitely don't talk about it.
So that's where you could, in Rutledge's book, you can actually write your side notes, right?
Yes.
Your marginal notes in the textbook as you're going forward. Well, I actually had thought about, after you inspired me in thinking that perhaps for my student that maybe I should buy the NorCal 40. It's now available. I'll put a link in that in the show notes page. You can now buy the board and all the parts again. I'm really gratified to hear that because I think hopefully Rutledge's book will be used by a lot of schools in order to develop an interest in radio and a real knowledge of how radio works. We're running over, and I'm enjoying this immensely. But I had some other questions that I wanted to ask you, because you have some other things that you're doing. I noticed that you're not afraid, for example, to buy eBay boards to use as test equipment. I saw that you bought a signal generator board. You're doing quite a bit of testing, and you're doing it just like an engineer. You're writing down all of the measurements that you're getting as you're sweeping up and down the band. What do you think about these boards that are coming out of eBay and from China to actually building a workbench that has some test equipment on it? Are they in fact usable?
To some extent, they are usable, but they are some of them are not. So, for example, the ATU-100, the N7 DDC's project for the ATU project, for which he has provided all the information on the web, on his GitHub page. There are several knockoffs of that available from eBay. One of the reasons why I buy from eBay is that AliExpress is banned. So, of course, I put both of them in the same bucket. Both are coming from China. For the most part, the people who are selling the cheap stuff on eBay, most of the sellers are in the China. The sellers, some of the better quality ones in other places like the US and Europe, unfortunately, they don't ship to India for some reason. I think maybe the shipping costs are high or something, so they don't sell their stuff to India. So I invariably end up with these Chinese sellers. So the ATU-100, for example, the ones I bought, there is a SWR bridge that it uses to measure the voltages to see. That's a crucial part of an ATU, right? You need to measure the, that's like a mid of an ATU. What they've done is they have put a regular rectifier diodes on it. So one and 4007 or something they put it. So you lost like 0.7 volts there itself, right? So N7 DDC's design assumes that you have very low drop-offs on those diodes. You use Schottky diodes for it. Like you use 5711, for example, 1N5711, which is like a Schottky diode. So these kind of problems are there, and you need to be really careful. You can't just buy them and just build them. And the signal generator, for example, it came with a two-wire plug, and if you just touch them, you get an electric shock. Like you get 70 volts AC on those terminal pins. And you will spoil both the circuit boards as well as yourself. Like you have a very high chance of getting electroculated.
Ram, are you finding that there's a community that will, say, buy this ATU-100 knockoff and then write notes on it, GitHub site or something like that, that says, change out the diodes from silicon to Schottky, maybe put power protection, things like that?
This information is like scattered all over the place. There is this EEV blog. He has a forum. He's this person from Australia. He runs a forum, old style forum website, where a lot of information about it is there. But you need to really dig through and try to find this information. And about the N7 DDC units, you have some GitHub issues where people have reported these things. Then they say that, oh, yeah, I did this, and yeah, it fixed these problems. You need to really dig into it. And it would be really nice if you have a website where somebody, like people do YouTube reviews and so on, right? Instead, if somebody just buys these things, or these people who are making these, they send some of these units to people who are knowledgeable and let them evaluate. And because I think the same manufacturers could have just put 5711 instead of 5007 or 4007 instead. I don't know why they made those mistakes.
Maybe they're not mistakes. I mean, they are kind of ripping off the design of somebody else, right? And maybe even duplicating the product of somebody else.
Yeah, and there is no acknowledgement of N7 DDC on their boxes or anything for that matter.
So they've stolen his design. Maybe he hasn't applied for a copyright protection or whatever, the intellectual property protection. That's very hard to do these days, and it's very expensive. You know, maybe there's also a way to let people know that, in fact, that the real design exists and that they should go to the designer. We have the same kind of issue here. I spoke at the beginning that we can get just about anything now from DigiKey in Israel. If we buy $100 or more, we get free shipping into Israel, and it just clears customs. If I order anything else outside of DigiKey or one of the big component houses, It's a real hassle to get anything through the post. And if it comes in FedEx or Emory or any of these places, they could charge $100 storage at the airport while you're trying to clear it. It's really a difficult thing. So I'm encouraging anybody that has kits that they want to send, they should talk to DigiKey. I would even pay that extra 20% or whatever that margin is that DigiKey wants in order to be able to just be able to get stuff.
Yeah, it's the same story here as well. Yeah, they charge like a huge amount for storage. So nowadays, what I do is there is a new company that has come in here. I don't think it's new. It's called Semicart. It's an India-based website. Semicart with K, I think. And what they do is they have a search interface. You could search for component. They are like an aggregator. They send these search queries to DigiKey and Mouser and Element 14 and a bunch of websites. You could place order like in small quantities and so on from them. What they would do internally, I think, is they aggregate all these. And so they would probably pass that DigiKey's $100 margin or something. Because like me, a number of other people would have placed order. So all those orders together to DigiKey may be like $200, $300. So then they get it in their facility and then they distribute it back to individual customers, I think. So it takes a bit of time and the amount that you need to pay, they have some flat rate for the shipping and handling. But overall, I think it turns out to be much cheaper.
I think our American cousins, they may not recognize how easy it is to get just about anything they want. And if you're outside of the United States, I have to talk to the Brits. I would imagine that they have similar issues. Because if you've got large government bureaucracy like we do here, they love to flag stuff at the airport, at the customs, and then they want all kinds of documentation on what it is you're actually bringing in. It's hard. I tried to bring in a connector from Alicraft, a connector. I finally said, just keep it. Well, we don't want to keep it. I said, it's not worth getting in the car and driving down there to pull out of customs.
Yeah, yeah.
Before we wrap up, I had a couple of things I wanted to ask you. You write in one of your blog posts that you have an interest in Carnatic music. And so I looked it up on YouTube, and I'll put a link. Perhaps you can even send me a link of something that you think is really representative of Carnatic music. But what is that? And you're studying it. Are you studying it to sing it? Or are you studying it to be the sitar player?
Yeah. So there are two streams of Indian classical music. One is called Hindustani Carnatic music. That is more practiced in the northern part of India. And this is Carnatic classical music, which is more practiced in the southern part of India. I am not learning anymore, but I'm still an avid listener and occasionally sing. My daughter is also learning now, and she's really following my footsteps as far as music and radio is concerned. And she's really interested. And she, maybe our interest in CW is somewhat related to music as well. So this is, I'll send you a link later on for some representative. There are instrumental as well as non-instrumental versions of it, like vocal singing. I used to do vocal singing, and I used to also sing in the All India Radio, which is a state-run radio station, when I was a student during my engineering college days. They give you like a 45-minute slot to sing on the radio, and usually it is broadcast live, so it's a bit, you're always nervous, like, oh, will I make some mistake? And this is with instruments accompanying you. There'll be a violin accompanying, and there is a percussion instrument called mridangam. They also accompany. So with these two, and it is highly intellectual. There are like these old composers who have composed these songs. But as a singer or a performer, you have some leeway in innovating yourself, like elaborating on a particular, what we call as a raga. Like each raga is like, it has a bit of a framework on what should be the tones that is possible, permissible for each raga. If you violate from that, then it's like a different raga. So people are very, very strict in following these things.
Like people that follow Italian opera, for example.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You sing right on the music. Your interpretation is what counts, but you have to sing right on the music. What I thought was very interesting was this appears to be a storytelling.
Yes.
It's not like American rock and roll is 32-bar pop song form where you've got two verses and a chorus and a verse, and that seems to be the formula. But what I was noticing with the Carnatic music is that it appeared like they were telling a story.
Exactly, yes, yes. And it is mostly centered around the Hindu, about the religious stuff. Because most of these old composers, they were like highly religious, and they take one of these older Hindu epics, and they, like, for example, Lord Rama, for example. Lord Rama is like one of the all-time favorite gods worshipped in India. And there is this epic called Ramayana, written about Lord Rama. And it has like a bunch of stories on various things that he has done. And so sometimes it is a plea to God that, why don't you save me from the situation? Or, yeah, sometimes it is like that. Some of them are stories, like a condensed form of Ramayana, for example, an entire thing. And there is also some lyrical prowess that some of the composers have shown, like some of the language, rhyming words that come at the end of each. So they've tried to innovate in their own ways.
Well, I think in the study of oral traditions, for example, that putting stories to music was a way of being able to, around the campfire, you know, pass the tradition down to someone else, because with the melody attached, it's easier to remember it. It's my understanding, at least from some of the education I've had, is that oral traditions tended to be more exact. Written traditions can be corrupted, whereas an oral tradition following the music tends to be more accurate.
Yes, it gets passed on as well, right? People tend to pick it up, and it gets passed on. Some younger kids learn this, and yeah, the hope is that the traditions are kept alive. So if I look at some of the Indians who have migrated to the US, for example, they seem to be more concerned about Indian traditions than the Indians living in India, for example. They follow some of the Indian festivals, that they learn these Carnatic music, for example. They employ teachers back in India over Skype or Google Chat, Google Meet, or some such medium. And they so religiously learn these things and follow the tradition so much. And I sometimes find it like, yeah, I'm living in this country and I'm not doing even 10% of what these people who are living abroad are doing.
Well, absence makes the heart grow fonder, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yes.
I think I get that from the standpoint of being an immigrant myself. The Great American Songbook is my favorite. The music my parents listened to was the music of my life. And so even though I'm in Israel, and I guess I could be following Israeli rock and roll, for the most part, I'm still in Nat King Cole, or I'm still in that era of music. And that seems to be, maybe it's because I'm away from it. Before we go, what excites you the most about what's happening in amateur radio now?
I think some of the things that I heard from the last couple of podcasts in your digital modes, that I think Steve Straw, I think he talked about, that episode was really, really, really wonderful. I so much enjoyed that podcast. Some of the things that he is doing, for example, the new digital modes, the signal processing, for example, I don't think we have even explored a tiny portion of what we can do with DSP. And the promise of DSP was that now it puts into the hands of people a bunch of software, and software is easy to modify. And so there'll be more and more people experimenting with radios. That was a big promise of SDRs, but I'm a little bit disappointed that not so much of people are modifying these things. It's still a fixed pipeline. If you see an SDR software, people are modifying the look and feel of code and so on, but not so much with signal processing algorithms itself. Like now we have machine learning advances and so on, convolutional neural networks and so on. And with that, I think probably we could invent some new noise reduction algorithm, for example, because the urban noise is so high. And now we need to invent new ways to operate somehow with whatever we have available. For example, the place where I live, it's extremely noisy and I don't have enough place to put a huge antenna. I have a small mock horn for 10 meters and a really compromised 40 and 20 meter dipole here. And I pick up all sort of noise from the neighboring house. It's like I can touch the neighbor's house from here. It's so close. And we live, cities in India are like very small plot sizes. So I think we need to invent newer algorithms, and we need to probably somehow, instead of aiming for the ideal conditions, we need to put up with what is available and try to invent new algorithms and new way to get rid of all these, again, Chinese, cheap Chinese-made SMPS and so on, right? Indian manufacturers are not doing anything. They just buy these Chinese LED bulbs and so on. They just put a label with their name on it and they sell it. And even the not the government or anyone, nobody cares about the noise on the amateur radio bands or any such thing.
I think part of that is because it appears to me anyway that a lot of the government officials have no idea what that really means, you know, what the implications of the noise are.
Yes, yes. Once they are hit maybe by military or someone gets hit by one of these things, maybe then they realize. But they operate on high power anyway, so maybe they may not realize all these things. But and they have huge campuses, so they probably may not realize it. But I think the one that really excites me is that there are a lot of youngsters coming in into the hobby. The number of amateurs in India is still very, very low. But when I look at the Indian Institute of Hams, when I went there for writing the exam, there were like so many people writing it. And even if, say, 10% of them really become practitioners, I think it is good in the long run.
What do you think is attracting young people to amateur radio in India?
I think in general, they are seeing some, I think the space program, the Indian space program is quite advanced. There are some bunch of hams in the space program. Have a ham radio club inside the Indian Space Research Organization office. And I know of certain hams who go from school to school doing demonstrations and so on. Popular press also writes about disaster management. I'm not so much interested into using ham radio for disaster management and so on. That is like, ham radio is not for that, right? We are like for personal improvements and trying to become better at doing electronics, and it's a hobby, and this is like a side effect, like we also can help during disaster when other things don't work. But I think press has played a big role, and plus a lot of volunteers also do a lot of work trying to spread ham radio. But I don't know whether some of the other states also has got this kind of uptake in the number of hams. At least here in this city, there are like a lot of, in Bangalore, for example, there are like a huge number of hams. Probably the largest number of hams in India are in this city.
And that's because of the high-tech bend of Bangalore?
Tech community, and there is the space and defense has got a large presence here.
And American corporations also have a lot of R&D.
Yes.
We should talk to Steve Hicks and see, maybe Flex Radio needs to have an R&D center in Bangalore.
Yeah, that'll be really cool. I remember when I was very excited about it, I wrote an email to them. I didn't know anybody at that time. I wrote an email, but I did not hear back. But yeah, I would love to do this as part of my job full time. That would be really, really, really cool.
To take them into the next generation, the 7700 series of radios there at Flex, which I'm sure maybe they've already thought about. I'm just making this up right now.
Yeah, even the Elecraft K4 seem to be huge, right? It has a lot of, it's like an SDR and huge number of stuff happening inside that. I've only seen some videos and was drooling over those, but those are very hard to get here. And even if I buy one from somewhere abroad.
Getting it in the country is difficult, yeah. I wouldn't think so. The last question is, what advice would you give to new or returning hams to the hobby? Now, probably new hams is more that what you're going to speak about, I would think, in India. But what advice would you give to them?
Get on the air as much as possible, especially HF. I see that a lot of people, the new hams, they buy a Baofeng or something and get on VHF. That quickly becomes boring after some time, because then people tend to compare with cell phones and so on. Like, oh, I can talk on cell phone. What's the difference between this and talking over the repeater? But ham radio is a lot more than that. Get on HF, and there is now QO100, which is accessible. We are so lucky to have QO100.
Are you on QO100?
Unfortunately not. I was listening on QO100, but I don't have a transmit setup. But I definitely plan to do that. And I also read somewhere that in the US, they are also planning something similar.
I'm in range of QO100. I've got all the pieces. I need to put them together.
Oh, yeah. Probably. Yeah, I'll also try to. That's one of the things I want to do in the next few months. Maybe we can have a QSO on QO100.
I'm looking forward.
That'll be great. Yeah. So that is definitely one advice. And I also would like more and more people to build things with their hands. And we have like a bunch of WhatsApp groups here. WhatsApp is hugely popular. I saw that in one of your QSO Today podcasts, that WhatsApp is popular in Israel as well.
Oh, it's terrible here. You know, everyone belongs to 50 groups. There's a WhatsApp group for picking up eggs on Friday.
Same here. Yeah, we have like every small thing gets created. So there are more people on, more radio amateurs on WhatsApp than on the air, is what I feel. Trying to buy and sell stuff and send good morning messages and spend so much stuff. Instead, I would advise them to get the cheapest HF rig possible and at least get a loop antenna or something, or experiment at least, put something together. Putting a DC receiver together is not that hard. And start monitoring the bands. I would really like more and more people to build things themselves, because that's one of the huge part of the hobby, right? Homebrewing and now parts are available, at least some of the simpler parts are all available locally, and with even with eBay or even ask one of these WhatsApp groups, do you have these parts available? People are happy to send to each other. I have myself sent parts to other people just for some postage costs or even for free sometimes. So that is a great thing about our community. People are really willing to help. So I think people should get on the air, try to build more stuff, spend less time on WhatsApp and other things, and instead do something creatively. Yeah, I would definitely advise more and more people to listen to these podcasts, like your podcast that was hugely motivational when I was not on the air for a long time for various reasons. I was out of home during the pandemic time with my parents for quite some time. I was without the radio. The podcast was my only window to amateur radio at the time. I used to listen to old episodes and so on. And similarly, this Older Smoke, I'm a big fan of it, and have emailed Bill and Pete.
Bill and Pete at Solder Smoke. I think podcasts are a great way to kind of keep in touch when you're not operating and when you're not building. If you're walking your dog or you're driving in your car, then podcasts are a great way to keep up. Rom, it was such a pleasure. It was an amazing pleasure to talk to you. I'm glad that you reached out to me. I'm always interested in talking to hams in other parts of the world. I've had a nice association with Asher Farhan for all these years since I interviewed him. He kind of lets me know kind of what's going on, but touching you is also a good way to know what's happening in India and with the projects that you have. With that, I want to wish you 73, and thank you so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, Eric.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Ram. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put in VU2JXN in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some of the episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, please contact me. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing on the subscribe buttons on the show notes page. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. Use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on what you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform, including Spotify and the iTunes Store. Until next time, this is Eric 4Z1UG 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.